got, you know, just some anecdotal, this will be my 29th spring here. Rick's been here longer, but the biggest increases, it seems, the biggest changes have been in about the past 15 years. And before this actually became an issue, I started making, noticing, I was here for about 15 years, when things seemed to be relatively stable in terms of, this used to be a pretty damp place. In the summer times, it seemed, it rained all the time. And the old timers said, you couldn't burn this country with a blowtorch. I mean, it was always acknowledged that there was no way that a forest fire could happen around here. Because I remember talking to old timers like Rocky Cummins and Jim Beaver. Rocky Cummins came up here in the 20s. He worked on the Panama Canal and when he was a kid and came up here. And these old timers reaffirmed what we were experiencing then in terms of rainy summers. And one of the things, I came up here in the late 70s, and I came up here, I'll just run by just a few things, anecdotal things that I saw in terms that were changes. I came up here to mountain climb. I love the mountains. And when I first came here and I saw that view from Ski Hill, I saw the glaciers and I saw the mountains. And so I became intimate with those mountains out there, and I could look at I would look at the different facets of the ridges and the peaks, and so I studied them because I loved them, that vista from Ski Hill, I could mark all the little spots on it that were significant to me. Mm-hmm. Well, holy mackerel, it's astounding the changes that I've seen in the Alaska Range just from the road here, how much ice has melted from that place.
So 29 years later, you're saying?
Actually, most of it has happened in the past 15 plus years. But actually, probably earlier on, of course, mm-hmm. But what I've noticed, and it was kind of starting obviously earlier on, but I really did. I mean, it's marked. And if you were to talk to a real expert like Brian Ochnicker or somebody like that, mm-hmm. I mean, he would. Then another thing that was interesting, my wife and I, we kind of homesteaded out here, and mm-hmm. I hand dug a couple of wells, and I dropped these cisterns in. And I pounded my well from there, and so each year I'd monitor our water table, our water column of our surface water, because it was significant to me. Because when it fluctuates throughout the year, and the water column would drop in the wintertime as things froze up. And mind you, this is surface water, but this year in particular, our surface water column has dropped way lower than it's been in the 30 years I've been around here, and so. It seems like perhaps, just this is an intuitive thing, perhaps our surface water isn't recharging quite as much. Also, talking to the old potato farmers out in this way, they used to love this place. Marty Hoskins and these guys were saying, this is the best ground for cellaring, for root cellaring. And we had a root cellar that rocked. It was great for years. But then, around 15 years ago or so, it would just give up the ghost. Our root cellar wouldn't stay as cool in the summer, all throughout the summer. It wouldn't hold its cool temperature for nearly as long. And it's like, geez, this is... another thing is that for the first 15 years or so, I moved to this area, and, in the 70s, throughout the 80s, into the 90s, I never once heard thunder or saw lightning. And I talked to locals. It's like, no, And I grew up back in New York State, where thunder and lightning was a big part of my childhood. I loved it, and I missed it about this area. And my conclusions about it was reaffirmed by the old-timers. No, it doesn't thunder and lightning around here. Well, holy mackerel, in the past 10 or so years, there's been some major thunder and lightning events. The skies, like the cloud formations, have changed markedly. There's these big, dramatic, animal-headed cumulus and all these billowing things that... haven't been happening, but they've been happening in the past number of years. Another one, we live on a little pond, and for the first 15 years or so we were here, the place was crawling with frogs, wood frogs. I mean, you couldn't sleep at night for the frogs. And 3 summers ago was the first summer that I did not hear one single frog croak. Hmm. Last summer and the summer before that, I heard some, but not like the abundance of frogs that we've had in the past.
Yeah, the other one that I remember specifically on that, on the difference in temperature, is that until probably about 10 years ago, in the fall, the first, you would sometimes, it would be cloudy up until August, then through August up to September, be above freezing. But the minute you had a clear night, you knew she was going to freeze. And about 10 years ago, you'd start, it would do that, it would clear up, and it wouldn't freeze, you know. And that was just an indicator that things are going up. And that was one of the ones that really attracted me. I said, that is really interesting, because up until then, it all, when it cleared up at the end of August, it froze. And then for the last time, no, it'll be clear for several nights and nothing freezes. So that's, you know, the temperature's going up. Plus the other one specifically, during the 70s, I don't think we lived in our cabin out in the woods for quite a while. And even, well, up until 80, you know, you'd have a cache for your meat and stuff. And it never thawed. I mean, it might get 30 degrees or something, but it never thawed. And then starting in the 80s, it'd get up to 35 a week or so. Then go back down to 20. But, you know, the temperature went up in the middle of the winter that you didn't see previously.
Another change that I'm just thinking is that, you know, although people around here now kind of complain about the mosquitoes once in a while, I tell you what, the mosquitoes now are not what they were like in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, we live on a little pond, and it took kind of major Zen experiences to be able to cope and live with that. I mean, and although we have, you know, we've had a few bad, but I tell you what, in the past 10 years, really, we haven't had continual mosquito outbreaks that we had, I mean, not even close.
Besides anecdotal observations, a group of local volunteers have conducted scientific surveys of local streams. From 2001 to 2006, Rick Ernst has coordinated the Citizens Environmental Monitoring Program. Through this program, 35 local volunteer monitors have collected 5 years of baseline scientific data on 8 stream sites in the Upper Susitna watershed.
Is a program where you get interested people in the community to take a training course. It's usually about 12 hours. We have taken sites on the creeks and rivers in the area to do some measurements that tell us how the streams are doing, how the water column is working. Over the last 5 years, we've monitored 8 sites, more or less. Some of them are a little more, some less, because we didn't start them all at the same time. And so monitors have gone there on a monthly basis and twice a month in the summer, and basically have made measurements on specifically dissolved oxygen, pH, temperature, some nutrients, phosphorus and nitrates. We've done coliform bacteria.
So are you measuring things that are harmful in the water, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. It's just we're trying to get what you call a baseline data set, i.e., up here the waters are fairly clean. I mean, we've taken that, and basically we found that true in the last 5 years. But nobody's ever taken a baseline data of what is a healthy stream here. So by knowing what those parameters are when they're healthy, if something goes wrong, we can start seeing, well, all of a sudden we have, let's say we have a spike of phosphorus for four months. Well, what's happening? Why is this? Naturally, there might be a certain amount of phosphorus, but all of a sudden you've got 3 times as much. Well, what's happening? Maybe something is going into the stream from a natural disaster, or a human event has added to that. So at least we know what the baseline is, and then we can make some estimation or try to find out why we have this exceedance of the phosphorus at the baseline level.
Okay,
yeah, that's critical. You know,
and you know, historically, if you go down lower 48. There have been, and it's always, you know, you hate to do that and say that you're always doing to be sure that people aren't doing the wrong thing, but we know for a fact that many industries have put material into waters, And then there haven't been baseline data studies done. All of a sudden, we say, hey, there's something wrong with this. They say, well, how can that be? Because where's the data
before? You can't prove it unless you have baseline data.
So you must have the baseline data, and it's very important to have that.
Citizen scientists have determined that our local creeks are pretty healthy overall. They are concerned about rising stream temperatures and their effects on salmon and other wildlife.
The one that I can feel pretty confident about is the temperature regime. And we have exceeded the temperature quality standards for the state in several of the streams in the summers. What that means at this point of time, we don't know, but I know all of Cook Inlet basin, all the way down to Homer, and there they've had these what they call exceedances of the state levels. For example, let's see what
we've got here. The water temperature.
Yeah. Is it the water temperature in this is the state water standards, and this is for water supply and aquaculture. May not exceed 20 degrees at any time. The following max 20 degrees centigrade. Mm-hmm. The following maximum temperatures may not be exceeded where applicable. Migration routes, and this is talking about salmon, basically, mm-hmm. should not exceed 59 degrees Fahrenheit. Spawning areas, 55 degrees Fahrenheit. Rearing areas, 59 degrees. Egg and fry incubation, 55. And those have been exceeded. I can't tell you exactly if they're spawning areas, but in our studies we've shown exceedances during the summer months. And this is all the way through the Cook Inlet Basin and the areas where they have the citizens monitoring program. And, temperature is pretty important because you have several things that happen. If you have decrease of oxygen if temperature goes up. You have increase of toxic chemicals as the temperature goes up, the metabolic chemical activity goes up.
Within the fish bodies, you mean?
Well, in the water itself, but that affects the animals, fish, crustaceans, whatever you have in the area. And we've had those exceedances in the summer.
Okay.
2004 was probably the most spectacular, and that was a really hot summer. Mm-hmm. So those are things that are of concern. I think they don't know exactly, what's going to happen, but I think we'll see, because time will tell what happens. I mean, you're going to have a natural selection versus some of the ones that can take that, mm-hmm. but what will happen to most of them, I don't know. So anyway, but that basically supports what's happening around the boreal areas. Temperature seems to be going up.
For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Nuggets. This is a pre-recorded conversation with Rick Ernst and Art Mannix about climate change in the northern Susitna Valley. As stream temperatures rise, so does concern about the future of the local salmon population. Keeping a thick cover of vegetation alongside streams can help to keep the temperatures down by shading the water.
I remember when the Cottonwood Creek Mall went in down at Wasilla, mm-hmm. and there was a huge deal about when they cut down all the trees all along Cottonwood Creek there, and that one of the main issues there was because the salmon were going to have less shaded areas to mm-hmm. spawn.
Rick is involved in an advisory committee that is helping the Mat-Su Borough devise riparian area development regulations.
There is no riparian rules in our borough about any of that along our streams.
So
there are state guidelines. This is Forest Practices Act.
Right, for the forestry you're doing in forestry areas, private lands and that at this point aren't, unless they're doing forestry on it. But so, there are no borough rules, and that's what this Title 17 that's being rewritten is trying to get some of that put into official, where people can, you know, do the best practices, because it's very important.
It's so important.
It's critical for for our salmon.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same?
There's a certain amount of land-based carbon, rough, woody carbon that can support salmon. And what's interesting is that, for example, on the interior, up in the interior rivers, the Yukon, they have less biomass in their fishery runs that are supported by more rough, woody carbon. And here down in South Central, we have a much larger salmon runs that are supported by less square miles of woody carbon. That being the case, there's a closer balance here, and it's more critical to protect our forestry resources, and just in terms of managing them properly, because there is a tighter balance relative to the interior rivers and the balance between the forests. There's a big relationship between the forests and the streams and the fish.
Art's comment about the importance of woody carbon forests to support salmon populations leads us to our next topic, the effects of climate change on our local forests. We live in the boreal forest, the forest that circles the northern part of our globe like a green crown, occupying 1/10 of the Earth's ice-free terrestrial surface. In our conversation, Art cited work, and I will paraphrase, from a book called Alaska's Changing Boreal Forests. This book was funded by the National Science Foundation and explains the long-term environmental research conducted by scientists and researchers from the UAF and Alaska Department of Natural Resources at the Boreal Forest Research Unit in Interior, Alaska. The book concludes that parts of the boreal forest have warmed more rapidly than any other place on Earth. Human activities release greenhouse gases, which are causing this warming, and these researchers' models predict that warming will now occur even more rapidly in the boreal forest than it has in the past.
We have fortunately escaped the severity of the spruce beetle epidemic that hit the Kenai, and it's widely concluded among the professional forestry community that those spruce beetle outbreaks are due to the warming temperatures, because basically the spruce are drought stressed. And when they're stressed, then they're going to be less susceptible to warding off insect infestation. And I can't figure out why it hasn't hit us yet. Now, what's interesting is that the stress on these plants isn't necessarily due to the warming temperatures. What it's more due to is the lack...
The spruce or the birch?
Both. It's more due to the lack of rainfall that is associated in some areas to the warming temperatures. In some areas, the warming temperatures could produce more rainfall. In others, they're saying that basically, and then in other areas, it could be producing drought conditions. It seems in South Central Alaska that the stress on the trees is mostly due to the drought conditions that have been induced by the warming. If you look at the spruce, it seems like around this area that the birch have been more stressed. These are my personal observations. The spruce has been somewhat more resistant. And if you see drying needles and needles that are falling off, if they're all on the flanks or the sides of the trees, that's something to be concerned. But you have to be more concerned if the top starts drying out. That's where you're running into big problems. And I haven't really observed that as much here. But if we keep having summers like we've had, not like last summer, but in the previous 5 or 6, it's going to be very, very radical, some of the changes that occur here. Due to what's going on is that the boreal forest, because of the melting permafrost up north, is starting to migrate further north up there. But in the south, because of the the drought-induced stress of the spruce down there and the beetle kill, it's retreating from the south. So our boreal forest is starting to kind of shift north. But in the middle of this, which is us, major compositional changes are going to happen. And these are changes that these guys are scratching their heads over. They don't know what's going on. I guess I'll hop into this industrial logging issue that's been going on here briefly. But since not much is known about how the forest is naturally progressing with these huge changing climate situation here, we don't even know how the forest is going to respond undisturbed by man as a result of these climate changes. How are we going to understand how it's going to respond once we start unprecedented levels of industrial timber harvesting?
change our